like they used to be.
Scratched.
Yes, welcome to SVR. It's John Barrett here. I'm going to do a show today, and it's a very indulgent show. It's I recorded this about 40 years ago, I think now, and it's all to do with Ralph McTell. Now, I know Sidmouth really has a lot of Ralph McTell down there, and I thought this would be interesting. I recorded this when we were living in Weymouth. I had to try to think back. And Sue and myself, we went down to the Weymouth Pavilion there, and we had a chat with Ralph McTell before he did a show. And the only thing about it is, he mentions it a little bit, but not really as badly as I'm going to mention it. He got in a tantrum that afternoon. The sound check wasn't going well at all. But I thought, oh my goodness me, he's never going to do an interview now. But he did. He was very professional. He got on with it. Anyway, let's listen to it now. And I'll play a bit of music at the end, and it'll be all Ralph McTell music. So I hope you do enjoy Ralph McTell. Here he comes. You were originally born in Farnborough, but I always thought you were born in Croydon, actually.
Yeah,
you knew there when you were pretty young.
Yeah, I mean, I don't remember anything about Farnborough at all, so I must have grown. I mean, to me, Croydon's my home, you know.
So
I knew.
You've written really two songs associated with your Croydon days. Obviously, was the Bentley and Craig song.
Oh, yeah.
And also Pick Up a Gun.
Yes. First of all, I'm very old and I can remember. Well, I don't know whether I'm very old or if I've just got a very good memory, because I can remember going back to when I was about 18 months old, and I've described things to my mother that I couldn't have known about, so she knows that I can remember.
Yeah.
And I think because of the things that happened to me when I was a kid, that things of as horrible and horrific as the Bentley and Craig case stayed with me, and I remember asking questions about, well, why is this, but he was under arrest and all this sort of thing. And growing up and playing around in the area where the incident took place and everything, it was always in my mind, and I thought, well, I'm one of these days I'll get that into a song, because it's so it's just such a terrible travesty of justice. So it took a long time, and then finally I thought, well, if I don't have a go at it, it'll never get done. And I had to, so I adopted a sort of an American medium of playing the guitar style, which is rather like somewhere a cross between bottleneck playing and the ballad style of playing that, say, Woody Guthrie might have used, and adopted it. He was a sort of model for me to write it in that way. The other song that you mentioned, Pick Up a Gun, from 1971, I suppose it was my own experiences as a kid, having joined the cadet force at school and doing very badly at everything, or really not doing badly, but just not caring, that I thought that the military get out would be honourable and get me away from home and solve all my troubles, instead of creating a whole set of new ones. And it's quite clear that certain guys flourish in those conditions and others become suicidal. And I guess at 15 it was clear that I was not cut out to be a soldier. And then it sort of threw into the whole moral aspect, because I discovered by myself when I was in the junior leaders down in Plymouth, which is where I was based, that I only found one boy in my whole intake that had two parents in the same house as himself, and it made me wonder. And I started talking to some boys, and gradually as we got to know each other, I found out that many of them were recruited straight out of orphanages and so on. So it just occurred to me that there was this fodder factory for the military, you know, that offering a career and something dignified on one hand, but actually just filling up the ranks. And I know the pressure that was put on us after I made an inquiry and so on. So I started to think, how can I put this into a song? Because conscription had ended, so I opened it with the adverts in the papers, solicit soldiers for the army, etc. And that was the idea for that. Yeah.
Was it easy to get out?
Well, no. I mean, the first thing that all the sergeants say to you is, oh, you give it a few more days, son, you'll get into it, you'll soon learn the ways. There's always one kind sergeant. I remember we had a Sergeant Mills that was very kind to me, and as for the others, I don't know how they're not locked up, you know, yeah. They're sort of complete sadists, but he was very kind, he sort of said give it some time, but eventually I managed to get discharged by purchase, which was a thing they don't encourage, but they basically say if you give the army back what the army spent on you, you can get out, but of course it's much more humane now. Things have been changed, largely due to a spate of suicides that were sort of taking place in camps and a lot of boys running away. I am talking of nearly 30 years ago, of course.
Yeah. So obviously after you left the army, you went to college, did you, or to tech?
Yeah.
And I mean, your recent LP was the Blue Skies Black Heroes, which is a tribute to the blues men, really, isn't it?
Yes.
Where did you originally hear them, though?
At college. I'd always liked that kind of more earthy end of the rock and roll scene. I liked early Presley, I liked the Donegan period, Skiffle period and so on. And I heard the playing of a bloke called Jack Elliott playing some Woody Guthrie songs and a song by Jesse Fuller at the jazz club at college one day, and I just was totally fascinated by it. And then when I listened closer to the lyrics, they had something to say, you know, they were kind of socially conscious. I mean, that word wasn't invented then, but that's what they were, and they appealed to me being quite young and full of all this, you know, awakening to what was going on around me. And I discovered Jesse Fuller, Blimey Fuller, Blind Blake, Blimey Fuller, Big Bill Brunsey, Muddy Waters, and you name them, and all this wonderful music started to come over to England in around about that time, 1960-61. And in fact, I first saw Muddy Waters at the Fairfield Hall, Croydon, in 61, I guess it must have been, yeah.
So, were you actually working during the day and then doing folk clubs at night as well?
Well, I went on the road after that for a few, I went on the road and had to play the guitar to get by. I wasn't really a professional busker or anything, I just sort of played the guitar outside cafes and got enough to eat and so on. And I did that erratically for about 3 or 4 years, I suppose, until I was about 21, and then I finished up in Paris, and I played there for a while, and then after I came back from Paris, I went into teacher's training college, because eventually I drifted into teacher's training college. But you don't want a whole biography,
that's the
way it went, you know.
Sure. But when you were singing in those days, was it your own songs?
Or oh, no.
You hadn't started writing?
No, I hadn't. I began writing in Paris, but I hadn't... I began writing tunes, and they weren't quite good enough to be played on their own, and they were really accompaniments to songs that hadn't yet been written, you know.
You didn't
and
have so the words, you had
didn't
the
have the words, yeah. No, not at that time.
So
no.
How did you get with Transatlantic then?
Well, I got heard in a club. I mean, it sounds like a fairy story, really. I got heard in a folk club doing some songs, and this guy came up to me after and said, did you write so-and-so, so-and-so? And I said, yes, I had. And he said, have you written anything else? And I said, well, you know, one or two bits and pieces. And he said, look, I'd like to introduce you to somebody. He said, I was a music publisher, but I've decided to drop out, and I'm a postman now down here. But I'll introduce somebody I think is quite trustworthy. And he introduced me to Essex Music, who turned me down, basically. But they were kind of interested. And then I sent some more stuff up and to them as they'd asked me. And then they said they'd like me to sign with them as a house writer, which was kind of, I don't know what that meant. I mean, in the old days, publishing houses had people, and they'd say, oh, we want a song for Joe Bloggs, and they would get out the writer that could write for Joe Bloggs. So that was what I was originally signed up. Well, I wasn't very happy with that. And then one day I sent in a song, I can't remember what it was, and this song had an audience response to it, rather than just me playing a song cold into a tape recorder. And they were immediately impressed, you know, because the audience seemed to like what they heard. And I signed a contract with Transatlantic to say that I wouldn't sign a contract with anybody else for 9 months while they made up their mind. And the 9 months went by and they made up their mind to sign me.
Because Transatlantic were the real folk sort of label at the time, weren't they?
Yeah. Well, more than just that, they were signing up singer-songwriters. No one else was. I mean, I think immediately of Bert Yance, who's a very good friend. And then later John Renbourn and Pentangle, and then later still Jerry Rafferty and Billy Connolly and all those. Yes, there were some, no one thought so at the time, but so many of those acts have lasted a lot longer than a lot of other people.
Yeah. Yeah. So it comes along really to the third LP, was your well-meaning Brought Me Here LP. Was
mm-hmm. Fourth.
fourth.
Yeah.
Three were Transatlantic.
Three were Transatlantic, yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
It was probably my favourite LP, I must admit. It stood the test of time pretty well, hasn't it?
Well, I don't know what it is about that LP. A lot of people like it very much. I think possibly it was the fact that Gus Dudgeon, my producer, and the new record company said, well, we won't stint on this. And they put, we had the London Symphony Orchestra on it. We had some of the best sidemen that were around at the time, who most subsequently all joined the Elton John band in some form or other, or went on into Yes or whatever. Yes, I think it was a period where I was beginning to actually believe that maybe I could write proper songs, you know. I mean, I don't say that I didn't before, but I was being taken very seriously by the business side. Paradoxically, at the same time, I was having trouble with my friends because, you know, I was moving away in terms of how people looked at me, how I felt I was being looked at, hence the title, You Well-Meaning Brought Me Here. I mean, in other words, it was the encouragement of friends that have brought me to this situation, and now I'm more confused than ever I was before. But the album, it has remained a favourite, and then the next one was sort of different again. I don't know what it is about it. I think I sing better now. I think my voice is better, but I'm not so sure about things as I was then.
I saw you about 1971, just after you brought Well Meaning Brought Me Here, and then again it was about 84, mm-hmm. and there's a tremendous difference in your confidence.
Yeah.
You really weren't very certain at all about 71 or two.
No, I wasn't. No, it was all these things happening. I mean, I was beginning to think that I could write songs, but the performing side of things was always iffy. But I think that in some ways it might have worked in my favour, because people could sense that they liked the songs, and they saw this person who was rather nervous up there, and they were kind of willing them to be better, you know. I mean, I actually did the Albert Hall in 73 or 74, I think, and it was full, and I hadn't had a hit record or anything, so I mean there was a lot of support out there.
So I saw you in Swindon, it was packed, but you could just see you were just not sort of stage struck, but you were very nervous. But of course, about this time as well, you played on a couple of Tom Paxton LPs, didn't you?
That was lovely. I mean, all my career, I think I've had support from, you know, the real guys. I mean, Tom is a really true, down to earth, no nonsense guy, and he was so encouraging toward me, you know. And I mean, I would, being modest and all the rest of it, and he would say, "Oh, come on, Ralph, that's a good song, man. That's a damn good song. You know, stop this kind of thing, you know." And although Tom lives in America and so on, and we are very different people, but we have mutual and strong respect for each other, and Tom's always been very loyal, where others have been jealous or, you know, niggly or whatever, or trying to work out why someone's successful and they're not, you know, and all that. Tom's always been true, and it was a pleasure to play on his albums.
He said the same about you, actually.
Did he really? Yes, he did, yeah. That's very nice.
Have you done much other session work, though, Ralph?
Well, it's a sad thing, isn't it? People think if you've got a name that you wouldn't be interested in doing it. In fact, I love to be asked to play on sessions. I've done sessions for, would you believe, from Des O'Connor to Lindsay DePaul, and then the Fury Brothers, and people you might expect, but they're usually people that, not the Des O'Connors and not the Lindsay DePauls, are usually people that, you know, work in the same medium. And you have to distinguish sometimes if they just want you because they want to stick your name on the back, or whether they really do like the way you play. But in the main, it's been the way that I play that they've liked, or it's suited the job, you know.
But as you say, you started as a guitarist, really, didn't you?
Oh, I did. I mean, it was ages before I could actually believe anybody was coming to hear the voice.
Let's go on to Christmas 74, when actually you were even on Top of the Pops those days, singing Streets of London, which you've been years before.
That's right.
World tours followed, and you were really a star of a capital S. But 15 years on, did you really enjoy the star treatment?
Nope. I was totally bewildered by it. I didn't know what was going on. I know more about the business now. I had no idea. You know, I just thought there was just more people being nice to me than there usually was. But it's amazing how quickly those people fade away and vanish when a thing goes cool. And also, in a way, I was unmanageable as a star thing, because I just didn't naturally aspire to being one. I mean, that jacket that you see on that cover was was bought for me by my manager. He said, you just cannot go around looking like a plumber anymore, you know, you now look less smart than the people that are coming to see you. He made me pay for it, but I mean, that was his idea, and like going to a barber to get your hair cut. I mean, I used to chop lumps off when it got long and things like that. You know, I mean, I had a kind of an awareness of a style, but it was sort of well-washed Oxfam or something. You know, I was just not, and it was right at that time, I guess. But when they started arriving for me in limousines, it was just rather pathetic and not right for me at all. I didn't feel right getting out of a big polished black Mercedes. I mean, I usually came on the bus or whatever. Yeah, I mean, I hate that kind of thing. I understand now when big, really big stars need protection. And I need protection too, in a way, because part of the thing of doing what I do and trying to do it as well as I can is that people regard you as a friend. You've been in their living room, they've listened to your music more times than you have on a record or something. And they feel they know you, so when they come and talk to you, you've got... Sometimes it's nice to be able to be removed from the situation in a nice way, you know, and be taken out and introduced to somebody else and so on. So everybody needs a degree of protection. But the actual overblown thing, it was always ironic, as you pointed out, that the song was old. And so it wasn't like something new. If it had been my latest song, I'd have been thrilled to bits. You know, oh, maybe I've arrived, but here it is, one of the first ones I've ever written.
Yeah. Still, let's go on in time. And it was television next, and I've got some young children. There I was Sunday seeing Ralph McTell. They're looking very nervous and uncomfortable.
Yeah.
Singing about animals on Alphabet Zoo. Mm-hmm. How on earth did that come about then?
Well, it was because the head of the music department at Granada wasn't English, and I'd done a session for a friend of mine up there for a music education, an educational program, the ones that they're compelled to make, you know, to fulfill their charter. And she said, oh, we've just had a guy and done a session, you know, I think he'd be good, why don't you ask Ralph McTell? And they went, oh, you're joking, you know, he won't do it, he's got his own thing going. And they rang me up and said, would you do it? And I said, no, I didn't want to do it. And they said, well, we thought you'd say that, that's why we would like to see you, so can we see you and meet with you? And I said, okay, and we met. And they said, the reason we want you is because we want you to write Ralph McTell songs for kids, not write kids' songs, you know, like over in the music corner. And I said, I don't have to wear dungarees and white kickers. And they said, no, you don't have to do that. And I said, because I'm older than most of these kids' dads are going to be anyway. You know, I'm 40, and I don't want to appear undignified or anything like that. Of course, eventually, I suppose I did undignified things, but in the main, I set about the criteria for doing the shows was that I could write a song that would entertain children rather than educate, and also hopefully entertain mum and dad a little bit at home, so I was able to do a bit of nice guitar work and so on. And my manager finally swayed me, said, Ralph, you've been listening to children's TV since you had kids, really. You've made lots of criticisms about it, as I had. And he said, you know, you'd be following the tradition of people you've admired, like Woody Guthrie and so on, all of whom have written songs for children. Yeah. So I thought, well, why not? And it just went crazy. I mean, it got to the biggest viewing figures I've ever had for a kids' program made in this country, you know, that time in the afternoon. And we had a lot of fun. I learnt a lot. I learnt that it doesn't matter which way you turn, the camera will get your worst side, you know, and all that bit. So, you know, in a way, it's great for the vanity because it strips it away, because you can't hide on a TV, in a TV studio. And I guess I sort of thought, well, I should be starting to get a little more confidence. So I think probably it helped me a lot. But it was time to call it a day after the second series, and I just said that. Thank you very much for the offer of yet another one, but I'll decline. No, I want to get, I want to get back to the other stuff.
So, well, actually, it's interesting. I was going to ask you, I was checking through LPs, and that you haven't really produced as much as I thought, considering you've been playing, what, for 25, 30 years. Do you suffer from writer's block at all?
Oh, yeah. I've always suffered from that. I mean, I was just thinking about a friend of mine who's an artist, and he keeps calling me an artist, and I think that it's wrong to say that anyone that writes a song is an artist. I think that I have artistic aspirations, but writing song is not, for me, a means of expressing myself. It's a means of communicating with others. And I think that a lot of art doesn't worry about communicating with others. It's about expressing and getting rid of your angst and emotions through music and words. But I don't feel that. I feel that this is a communicative skill, and that I desire to communicate principally first, but in an artistic way if I can second. I mean, art nearly always ends up having to be sponsored. I go out and earn my living with my guitar, and so I think it's slightly different. So obviously, because of that, and caring very much about the subject matter of the songs, you run out of ideas, or not necessarily ideas, but the right way to express them to reach the most people. Because if you, and you seem to know a lot about my music, if you look at it generally, it's not easy listening. It's easy to listen to, but the subject matter that I write about is not necessarily easy going at all. And I don't want to always be controversial, but I want people to know where I stand on some issues, or to be able to presume which side of the party I'm on, whatever. And to write things that touch on things that maybe other writers avoid. Try some difficult things.
I imagine it's the words that is the hard side of it, then.
It is, yeah. Because I'm not as educated as I should have been. And I mean, I don't particularly read a lot of novels or anything. I read a lot of poetry, funny enough. I quite like poetry. I read that late at night. And I don't read novels and things. So if I'm trying to express a thought, I often don't know what the thought is. It sort of emerges as the writing goes on. And that's why I often spend time explaining a song, which I shouldn't really do, I suppose, but I think it's part of the communication, if you like.
Yeah, sure. You're in the middle of a tour at the moment, aren't you?
Yeah.
Out of interest, do you really know where you are half the time when you're on a tour like this? I mean,
the simple answer is no. We certainly don't know what day it is, unless, you know, there's a lot of activity on the street. Is it a Friday? Is it a Saturday? You know. No, I see. I think if you worry about that, where you are, and how many miles to travel, you get away from the job. The job, you must try and preserve everything and all the energy for the show that night. That comes first. Due deference, interviews, radio broadcasts, TV, everything comes second. It's the people that have paid to come and see you that I'm thinking about from the moment we get in the truck till when I actually walk on stage, and then I can relax, you know. So it's quite a long day. But because people I'm not having to win people over, they're coming because they think they know what they're going to get, I'm enjoying it more now than at any time ever in my career. I mean, I can't believe that guitar sitting there has raised a family of four kids, you know, and taken care of me. I mean, it's just... it's staggering, and that for so long.
It's great to have a job which you can enjoy doing.
Absolutely, I'm a very lucky man.
Well, thanks a lot, Ralph, because you've got to get on stage in a minute. And thanks for the interview.
Very, very pleased to do it. Thank you.
Okay, that's Ralph McTell. I think we better have a bit of Ralph McTell music to go with all this. And I've been going through my LPs, and hang on, let's push this up a bit higher. Yep. And I'm going to play some of the tracks which we mentioned. And I hope you enjoy them. I thoroughly enjoy them because I'm a big Ralph McTell fan anyway. And what more can I say? The first one is all about Bentley and Craig. And an interesting point that I had an aunt, my mum's sister, used to live in Croydon. And we used to go up there in the summer holidays, I think, more than any other time. And Bentley and Craig was well known around Croydon, there's no doubt about it. I mean, what kind of thing we had in this country? We were hanging anybody, weren't we? Bentley. No, wait a minute, I gotta get it right. Craig. Craig was the one who let him have it, and that's what he got done for. Terrible, terrible. And we had Christie, wasn't it? What was his name? Oh, crikey, I'm having a blank moment here. Yes. He was a warden in the Second World War, and he was killing all these people, and they hang somebody for that. Not completely innocent. And of course, Ruth Ellis as well. That's all been about these people who really should never have been, you know, committed and died anyway. Let's listen to Bentley and Craig now. Mr. Tom Paxton. No, it's not Mr. Tom Paxton. It's Mr. Rolf Mattel. And I hope we'll get there. I'll get there eventually. Here we go. Here it comes.
Not 52 in Croydon. There was bomb sites still around from the war. November that year, food was scarcely off the ration. Two boys went out to rob a store. Craig, he was just about 16 years old. Bentley, he was 19. But Craig had a shooter stuck in his pocket, made him feel more like a man. Out on the roof of Barlow and Parker's, somebody saw them there. In a matter of madness, the police had arrived, and when they saw them, you can bet them boys were scared. Craig, he shouted that he had a gun. Then he thought about the movies that he'd seen. Back at Farrell, Law did sign the rifles out and arrived very quick back on the scene. Some of the police had got onto the roof. Bentley knew that he could not escape. So he gave himself up and they put him under arrest. And he begged his young friend Chris, won't you do the same? Ah, give me the gun, the sergeant cried. Let him have it, Chris, poor Bentley said. But the shot rang out, wasn't it all the night in half, and the poor policeman was a lying there dead. Both wives found guilty of murder. Craig was too young, not yet a man. Though he was under arrest when the fatal shot was fired, Derek Bentley was judged old enough to hang. Bentley, he was judged to be a man. January in Wandsworth Prison, when they took poor Bentley's life. Some people shouted and some people prayed. Some people just hung their heads and cried. Are you mad on our behalf? Who sanctioned that boy's death? There's still one thing left to do. You can pardon Derek Bentley, who never took a life. Who Derek Bentley cannot pardon you. Derek Bentley cannot pardon you. Not a 52 in Croydon town. There was bomb sites still around from the war. In November that year, food was scarcely off the ration. Two boys went out to rob a store. Two boys went out to rob a store.
That It's a story all about Bentley and Craig. As I say, we used to live, well, my aunt used to live in Croydon, and it was well talked about at the time, because Roald Patel's about 2 years older than me, and if you listen to the, if you heard it through, you realise that this was all recorded about 40 years ago, I think, but it's really a good recording, and I thought it's something a bit different to put on. And on this one, we'll play another one now, all about Buy Me a Gun Now, and that's again is when he joined the the forces, Roald Patel. Here he comes again, I hope.
The adverts in the paper solicit soldiers for the army, and they never tell you nothing about the girls in the garrison towns, like how they will mistreat you and how old friends will see you when you trade your name for a number and a uniform of brown. When you pick up the gun, when you say goodbye to mama and away from home you run. Now the way that sergeant shouted, that is just to drive you crazy. I was luckier than many though, for I got released in time. Now they tell me I'm a free man, but sometimes I still doubt it, for the more I think about it, freedom's just a state of mind that they keep with the gun. Thank you for the gift of your son. Praise the Lord and bless the bond. Politician tells the people, you gotta have an army. And the soldier tells the writer, the pen is mightier than the sword. But sticks and stones can break my bones, and words will never harm me, said the poet and the writer to the soldier with his words. I will be done, said the preacher man, lowering another pole. Set the dead of God to the glory. You can play with the words, but you won't change the story. Strength in their hearts and fear in their eyes. Old soldiers never die, they only fade away. But the young ones do not die, no, they are cut down instead. And someone pulled the trigger, gave the order, held the sword. And someone wrote the advert in the paper that they read. I will be done, but you won't get your hands on my son. You can wait till kingdom come.
Is we're listening to Roald Patel here, and we're going to move on now, and it's from Alphabet Zoo, and Philip, Glenn and Kate, they all got this signed. And because I've had to get the LPs out to check them all and all that sort of thing, clean them all off, because it's real vinyl you're hearing here. And we're going to hear all about Kangaroos now. So let's hope it all goes all right. And it's game. All Ralph McTell. I hope you enjoy it. Here it comes again.
Time for a quick drink. Right. Oh, my name is Kenny and I'm a kangaroo, garoo, garoo. I like to say good day, good day, good day, and how do you do? And if you were ever to ask me what I really love to do, I'd say boing around all day all over Australia. There's one thing about old baby kangaroo, garoo, garoos. Everyone is a bouncing babe, their mums are bouncers too. And if you ever caught up with us to ask what we love to do, we'd say boing around all day all over Australia. The worst thing that can happen to a kangaroo garoo is for him to lose his boing and his bounce. He doesn't know what to do. When mud goes hard around your feet and you're really stuck like glue, and you should be boinging and bouncing round Australia. We try to be brave as kangaroo, garoo, garoo, garoos, till someone creeps up behind us and they give us a scary boo. With a glop and a glug I was out of the mud and out me rooskin too, and I boinged off into the night in old Australia. Australia is great if you're a kangaroo garoo. There's plenty of space around for you to go boinging and bouncing through. The koalas and the kookaburras all go how'd you do, and they wish they were boinging too all round Australia. Oh, my name is Kenny and I'm a kangaroo, garoo, garoo. I like to say good day,
good day,
good day, and how do you do? And if you're ever to ask me what I really love to do, I'd say boing around all day all over Australia.
Yeah, this one's fading out now. So we're going to have a few Ralph McTell, and it's from the Well-Meaning Brought You Here one, and these are my favourite LP, so here we go.
I am your noble savage, but to me I am a man, the father of my sons and the server of my woman. And I have made my bow, I take only what I need. I am the maker of fire, I'm the planter of seed. And I have learned an order in things, and I teach my children, for each seed a star, to each son a generation. I have no time for freedom, barefoot I run on the forest leaves. There is pain in birth,
but for the dead I do not grieve. I have cut marks on my body, there is beauty in pain, and the sadness in joy, like death and the sunset. I am the willing heathen, I worship everything. I will add new words to my language, but write them on the wind. I am the maker of music and the reader of the heavens. I am the worker of magic and the fearer of storms. La, la, la. I am the writer in sand. I am the first and last man. And if I could read the future, I would ask you not to come.
Yes, there's a full production on this, isn't it? He didn't tell lies. Robert Tell, we're here listening to.
I can tell by your laughter, you think you know what I'm after, and I don't mind that you know, I'm just sorry I let it show. I can tell by your eyes that the suggestion comes as a little and no surprise, and you don't mind that I know, or you wouldn't have let it show. I can tell by your walk, I won't need to make small talk when we get home. Like ask your name and then promise to phone. Your smile that tomorrow you will not think that it's been worthwhile, and I don't know what to say to prove it need not be that way. And I don't know what to say to prove it need not be that way. I can tell by your crying you'd only think I was lying if I said what I know to be true, that tonight in some way I love you, that tonight in some way I love you.
There, we've got about another 15 minutes to go of Ralph McTell today, and he comes down to Sidmouth once a year anyway. And let's listen to him again.
So I asked the landlady, do you really think I'm crazy? Spending my time in here, drinking down your watery beer. Then she said that life's too short to spend your time wrapped in worried thought. Oh, come on and drink up, dear, and lay your money down. 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 But I said, well, there must be more. When some man said he fought in the war for me and I was ungrateful, he said, give me another drink, Mabel, for all those good times then. And Mabel said, you can say that again. And they did till they were unable. They laid their money down. They laid their money down. They laid their money down. They just laid their money down. Silence. I tried very hard to make sense of the things that the man did say. When he turned and quickly walked away, all he said was, time is money. Oh, I've gotta go now. And I thought, that's funny. Did he really risk his life for me? Or just lay his money down? Or just lay his money down? Just lay his money down. I come and lay your 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 money down.
Yes, we're going to have a couple more tracks. The last one will be obvious. But the next track is my favourite one that he's ever composed. It's just my own personal preference. And it reminds me of the first dog we ever had, Travis. He was an old brown dog. And yes, it's all about him. Old brown dog, Mr. Ralph McTell. And he did this one when I saw him in Taunton a few years ago. He played piano. That's why he could play it. Or we do it anyway.
That old brown dog sleeps in the rain, unless the sun has shone. That old brown dog is all alone, since old Bill been gone, and sleeping in the rain only gives the dog a bad name. If Bill were alive, I know he would decide to have the same thing done. That old brown dog smells so bad, say the people from the town. That old brown dog is almost lame, someone should put him down. Did it be an act of kindness? You know, it'd be for the best. You bring a rope, I'll bring my gun. It'll be all over for the dog can guess. Could an old brown dog have become wise? Guess they were after him. His hearing was failing, and his eyes were
were fast growing dim. On the day they come to kill him, he sensed a rabbit on the log. Did anybody see a rabbit chased across the meadow by an old brown dog? That old brown dog, tail wagging as he laid himself down, it did not seem to matter. His old heart ceased to beat. High above the meadow, the skylark singing as the spark went out.
Me, that's just the Rolf Mactell track. It just reminds me so much of Travis, it makes me a little bit sad even. And we're going to finish today with the one that you probably thought he actually, one time he didn't want to play this one at all, and really I don't blame him because everyone sings along to it and all that sort of thing, but I suppose he's got used to it now. Tom Paxton says he had a word with him and says, come on Rolf, you've got to play that one. People pay good money to see you, so therefore they want to hear that hit. So let's finish with that one, but this is not the original one. It's on LP called Even on a Bar, I forget what it's called now. Let's have a look. Let's move that one over. Move that one. It's called At the End of a Perfect Day. And yes, it's not a good LP, and it's... Well, Rolf Mactell won't mind me saying it, I don't think now anyway. It's not a good LP at all, but it's got this track on it, which I suppose he wants to you all to hear. And when this one finishes, we shall go straight into the jingle, and that will be the end of the show. What a way to finish. Anyway, here it comes, Streets of London, of course, Mr. Rolf Mactell. Thanks again, Rolf. Years ago we did this, but never mind.
Have you seen the old man in the closed down market, kicking up the papers with his worn out shoes? In his eyes you see no pride, and held loosely at his side, yesterday's paper telling yesterday's news. So how can you tell me you're lonely, and you're saying for you that the sun don't shine? Oh, let me take you by the hand and lead you through the streets of London. I'll show you something to make you change your mind.
Have you seen the old gal who walks the streets of London? Dirt in her hair and her clothes in rags. She's no time for talking, she just keeps right on walking, carrying her home into carrier bags. So how can you tell me that you're lonely, and just say for you that the sun don't shine? Oh, let me take you by the hand and lead you through the streets of London. I'll show you something to make you change your mind. And in the all-night cafe at 11:15, same old man sitting there on his own, looking at the world over the rim of his teacup. And each tea lasts an hour and he wanders home alone. So how can you tell me you're lonely, and just say for you that the sun don't shine? Oh, let me take you by the hand and lead you through the streets of London. I'll show you something to make you change your mind. Have you seen the old man outside the Seaman's Mission? Memory fading with the metal ribbons that he wears. And in our winter city, the rain cries a little pity for one more forgotten hero and a world that doesn't care. So how can you tell me you're lonely? You say for you that the sun don't shine. Oh, let me take you by the hand and lead you through the streets of London. I'll show you something to make you change your mind.
If you would like to contact Sid Valley Radio, we'd love to hear from you. You can message the studio from our webpage. Just go to sidvalleyradio.co.uk and follow the link on the contact page, or download our free iPhone or Android app, available from the App Store or Google Play. You can also text the studio on 07565 825 041. Or you can email the studio, studio@sidvalleyradio.co.uk. And don't forget, you can find us on Facebook and Twitter at Sid Valley Radio.